Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. It's another Monday in Trump world. I'm Charlie Sykes. Monday in Trump world means that the vice president goes down and has an absolutely shambolic visit to one of the camps on the border and says everything is fine. The pictures indicate they aren't. And yet that's almost completely forgotten. It's because we've moved on to what else the president's tweets over the weekend. We have a special guest today, Jane Costin, whose title is senior reporter at Vox with a focus on conservatism and the American right. Thanks for joining me, Jane.
Oh, anytime.
Now, are those two different things, conservatism and the American right?
They are indeed two separate things. And it's funny because I have in my Twitter bio that I write about conservatism, the GOP, and the far right and white nationalism. And sometimes folks are like, but those aren't all the same thing. I'm like, yes, I'm well aware those are not the same thing. Like, Richard Spencer is not a Burkean conservative. But I do think that all of the interrelation between all of those things, one of the things I do on Twitter a lot is just say the word guardrails a lot, because I think that one of the failings of the conservative movement over the last, say, 30, 40 years has been this idea that if you are opposed to the left, then you are welcome and thus are inherently good, which is why, you know, you get Milo Yiannopoulos at CPAC or something like that, when you a guardrail would say, like, just because he agrees with us does not mean he is a conservative or should be at this event. So, you know, I draw a distinct separation, especially because I think conservatism is, like, you know, the philosophical project, whereas the right is what it actually exists.
So you have a very unusual job. I mean, your job is to explain conservatism to liberals, right?
Somewhat, yes. And I think that it's challenging because there are sometimes where I'm aware that there's kind of, especially after 2016, there was kind of this cottage industry of writers going to, like, some diner in Pennsylvania to explain Trump voters to people. And I'm like, you know, I don't think that is not what I do. But, you know, I've been pretty enmeshed in conservatism and, more importantly, movement conservatism, what it actually looks like on the ground. And I've been doing that for a long time. You know, I was editor in chief of a conservative libertarian newspaper in college because the world works in mysterious ways. But, you know, essentially I'm attempting to make, you know, if conservatism is having an argument about something, or if there's something taking place, or, you know, on the right, I don't want to just say, you know, here's what's happening. I want to try to get at why this is happening. You know, when there was kind of the Sourabh Amhari, David French dust up about a month ago, which is still ongoing, you know, I wanted to get at, like, this isn't just about one person being very mad about drag queen story hour at libraries. This is also about, like, what is conservatism and what is the point of conservatism?
Well, you've probably seen what Jonah Goldberg refers to as the conservatives in the mist, the kind of progressive reporters sort of parachute in. Who are these strange creatures? What do they believe? And I'm always struck by the number of articles I read where it's very clear that the person writing it has never read a conservative book, has never really had a conversation. But you have. You actually spend your life, you're described yourself as a— You're a gay Christian, right?
Mm-hmm. That's
okay.
Correct.
A progressive who spends their time immersed in right wing stuff. That must be weird.
Yep. It's
I mean, that
strange.
Must be disorienting. I mean,
it's been interesting because I think that's, you know, one thing I would say is that I don't think I would describe myself as a progressive. I think sometimes I'm like, I'm a left leaning libertarian who's mad all the time, whatever that would be. Because as far as I can tell, being a libertarian is just being angry all the time. But it can be disorienting, especially because there are, you know, and I've talked about this and I think it's pretty obvious, is that there are two entirely separate media bubbles that exist. And it's not just about, you know, how are we reflecting on one story. It's not necessarily, you know, the New York Times says this thing where they're like, okay, here are what people across the political spectrum are saying about X issue. So they'll ask, you know, what is someone at Mother Jones saying and what is Molly Hemingway at The Federalist saying? But now we're getting to the point of, like, having two entirely separate news cycles where one group of people is very upset about Trump's Twitter and another group of people is very upset about a Connecticut trans runner. And you're like, okay, we're dealing with two entirely different sets of not just, you know, reflections on news, but two entirely different sets of news. So that can be kind of disorienting because they're, you know, I routinely have my editor saying, like, I see all these people who are very mad about something, but I don't know what they're mad about. And I'm like, I explained it on a podcast recently, of attempting to explain drama going on at a high school you don't go to.
Well, I sort of toggle back and forth between being angry all the time and being depressed. So I'm not sure. I think my better self is the angry self. There's so much to be angry about. You are right about the completely different alternative universes. And every once in a while, somebody will say, you know, well, why won't conservatives speak out about X? And the answer is, well, because they don't know about X. They don't care about X. This is what they're talking about right now. They are talking about a completely different set of storylines, narratives, and outrages. So it's not like you're having a conversation and disagreeing. It's the complete talking past one another. The other thing that I like about your stuff is that you do make these distinctions. And every once in a while, you'll see, and, you know, as those of us who are, shall we say, Trump skeptical conservatives or center-right conservatives, that we get lumped in with that you own, you built everything. And I try to say, you know, nuance actually matters. You know, Milo is not Edmund Burke. Hubert Humphrey is not Che Guevara. These distinctions actually do matter, and they're important.
Right. No, they absolutely do. And I think that that's something where you get, I feel like I understand people's annoyances with trying to break down these terms into their basic parts, or trying to say, you know, this, you know, X person is not an actual neo-Nazi or something like that. Because I'm aware that, like, what they're actually mad at is what the person is doing. You know, what they're actually mad at is, you know, undocumented immigrants being kept in really poor conditions. What they're really mad at is, but then, you know, when it's something like Trump is Hitler or something like that, I'm like, all right, hang on a second. You know, I wrote my honors thesis at Michigan on Nazi propaganda before and after the Battle of Stalingrad. So I'm legally required to be like, hang on a second. Okay, let's break this down a little bit. Also because I sometimes joke that I just don't think people have heard about enough like dictators. And I'm like, why does no one compare him to like Pol Pot or like, you know, I could think of a number of other interesting, you know, we could talk about the Khmer Rouge or something like that. And like, just, you know, let's widen our comparisons a touch.
Right.
But I think, you know, language matters. You know, I'm actually working on something about the term woke, which has become something that, you know, the right is using, but it's used as an interchangeable term for just liberal, when that's not what it means at all. You know, woke came from African-Americans thinking about kind of this sense of righteous paranoia about this idea that like the government is actually trying to kill you, or they are trying to do, you know, that was what stay woke meant. Stay woke was the same, you know, the people who were saying stay woke in like 1982 were the same people who thought that the government was flooding, you know, African American urban areas with crack on purpose. You know, that's where this came from, the idea of staying awake to the lies of the man. And it's just, it's fascinating. But, like, words matter. You know, how we describe things matters. You know, when we're talking, you know, I get really irritated a lot in my job because there are so many times where I'm like, okay, we need to get at what we're actually arguing about. And sometimes the linguistic back and forth, I understand, can get really irritating, but it's important because, you know, when we define our terms and are careful about what we're actually trying to say, that it foments more discussion than it hinders.
Well, and there are real world consequences. I mean, if somebody spends years saying Mitt Romney is a racist, George Bush is a racist, John McCain is a racist, then when the Richard Spencers and the Donald Trumps come along and you go, okay, those guys are racist. No, this is the real thing. Okay, we didn't really mean it before. Okay, so on woke has the feeling that it's almost worn itself out at almost like warp speed. Have you seen Aziz Ansari's new Netflix show?
I have not yet. My spouse was watching it. We went to New York over the weekend. I had to do Reliable Sources. And so my spouse was watching it and enjoyed it. But I think it's interesting because it's on the list of...
It's hilarious.
You know, I've had a couple of African-Americans friends who have talked about how like sometimes a term, it'll just go from being like Black Twitter to everyone using it to, okay,
right,
we're done with it now.
Right.
And
yeah,
it's just interesting how that cycle seems to go, that, you know, this is something where, you know, you're seeing Ted Cruz use the term. And then I ask people, you know, I've been emailing and asking all of these people, like, where was the first time you heard this term and what do you think it means? And you hear from people like, well, the first time I saw it was on Twitter. And I'm like, okay, that's already, we're in an interesting place. But it's interesting. But I want to go back to a point you made earlier about how, you know, saying that George W. Bush was racist or John McCain was racist, you know, I think it's interesting because John McCain was the victim of a racist attack in South Carolina, sure. If you'll recall, with the allegations about his adopted child. But I also think that, you know, occasionally, I think I encounter this a lot with conservative journalists or just, you know, people, generally white journalists traditionally, is this idea that racist is an insult. Like, you know, you'll see people who...
Well,
you know,
yes.
They posted something really mean about Michelle Obama on Facebook, something really racist. And someone says, hey, that's racist. And they're like, no, I couldn't possibly be a racist. No, I'm like, no, it is. And so I think that one of the challenges here is that racist and racism are descriptors. You know, someone, and I know, I think it's also challenging because I know I've done racist things and that it's not a, when we use it as an insult, when we use it as something that's just like, aha, you're like, that's not what this means. And so I think that there have been many times in which Republicans before 2016 subsumed themselves to racism or subsumed themselves to racist tropes with the understanding, perhaps cynically, that like that's the right thing to do politically. And, you know, you see folks, and I think that you know, that in itself is interesting, but I think it's worth noting that people can be different. There are gradations to racism.
Yeah, give me an example of that. Give me an example of subsuming yourself to a racist trope.
I think that, you know, and you saw this with Bill Clinton, for example, where you see this idea of welfare reform in the early 1990s, welfare, which is, you know, the majority of people who receive welfare benefits in the United States are white. That's just mm-hmm. how it is. But the idea of welfare reform was very much a racialized concept. And, you know, when Clinton was coming in, I think we don't talk in general about how awful January 1993 was for the Clinton administration. Like, it's like, you know, you get elected and then you just immediately get shoved under a bus. But the idea that, you know, this is what you have to put welfare in these specific terms in order to reach these specific people. You have to make it about how, you know, your benefits are fine, but these benefits for these other people, you know, the so-called welfare queens. There's actually a great book on that whole concept, by the way, by Josh Levin that just came out. But, like, you know, this idea that, like, you know, Medicare, that's okay, but these, you know, food stamps, that's not okay. Like, there's, you know, acceptable kinds of quote-unquote government handouts, you know, just depending on who receives them and who doesn't. You know, you've seen the same things with WIC benefits for women and children, where how that's parsed out is a very specific, okay, who benefits from them. And then, you know, but then there are other benefits, or, you know, even how we talk about, say, like the opioid crisis, for example, which... And a lot of people have pointed this out, that like the opioid crisis is now, and it's a good thing that we're talking about people who became addicted because of prescription medications, or we're talking about people in a very sympathetic way, which, you know, if anyone went through a DARE program and, you know, in the 1990s or early 2000s, that's not how we used to do this, because the people who were believed to be, you know, behind the drug trade or behind, you know, opioids, in the 1990s, you know, that's where you get super predators. That's where you get this idea that, like, the best thing to do is to lock these people away from your children, not the idea that these people could be your children.
Right. No, very, very much. I mean, I'm actually thinking this through, going back and seeing how easy it is to slide into all of that. And I'm somebody that wrote a book called A Nation of Moochers. I tried to balance it out by talking about corporate welfare, but the passion on the right about corporate welfare was never the same as the passion about going after AFDC or food stamps. And that's there's no question about that. So since we're on the issue of race and racism, okay, I'm sorry, before I get to that point, I'm going to interrupt myself here. You know, one of the things that I noticed on the right, and I'm older than you, I grew up during the 60s and the 1970s at a time when to call someone a racist was in fact one of the most, you know, one of the most serious charges you could make. It was the nuclear bomb of American politics. No one wanted to be considered a racist who was remotely respectable or wanted to be taken, regarded as credible in any way. The problem, I think, on the right was, and I think the right was extremely sensitive about this for a very long time, but after a while really became numb to it. And I started seeing this in recent years, the kind of the you know, eye roll, shoulder shrug, going, okay, whatever I do, you're going to call me a racist. I don't care anymore. Go for it. And I think that there was a certain numbing to it. So that by the time Donald Trump came along with the no longer engaging in dog whistles in any way whatsoever, you know, people said, well, that's racist. Conservatives were not, they didn't blanch at that. They weren't embarrassed or humiliated, because they kind of you know, shrugged their shoulders. Like, you know, whatever, you've been calling me this for 20 years. I might as well just stop caring about it.
Well, I think that the interesting thing is that when people were, you know, when Jackie Robinson protested outside the 1964 Republican National Convention because of Barry Goldwater's nomination, with the argument that Barry Goldwater and the people who were arguing for him were engaging in racism, nobody listened. You know, and I think that there's something to be said about the fact that, you know, how saying something is racist has been parsed out has been in very specific ways. And, you know, how it's impacted people has been, again, very specific. You know, you can think of the legacy of, you know, GOP and Democratic congressmen in the 1960s and 1970s who engaged in abject racism. Mm-hmm. But, you know, where that was kind of parsed out as, like, telling it like it is, or, you know, mm-hmm. saying something that's, you know, oh, the mainstream media doesn't want to hear about this, which, doesn't that sound familiar? But
very.
I think that the response to, you know, if someone says something you're doing is racist, my first thought, you know, and I've had this moment relatively recently where I used the term kabuki theater. Mm-hmm. And someone was saying, you know, that, you know, for a lot of Asian Americans, like, kind of how that concept is made, it can be really racist. And I was like, oh man, that's something I did not know. Whoa. Like, and so I Googled and I read about it and I was like, I won't say that again. It's not that difficult for me to not be a terrible human being. And so I think that there's
really, I love that phrase. No, seriously. I have used that phrase for years, and now you're telling me that it's racist if I say that, you know, that what you're seeing is the kabuki theater of the House Democratic leadership is pretending to be something or other. That, I mean, aren't these the invisible tripwires of grievance that people are kind of exhausted by?
The thing is, though, that I think, one, I don't think that they're invisible if someone's telling you about them. But I would also say that there's a sense, and, you know, I talk about this a lot, this concept on the right of, like, patriotic correctness.
Oh, yeah.
That, like, how dare mm-hmm. you sneeze near a flag or something like that. And
that's
so I would
true.
Say that this kind of grievance, you know, whether or not you think of it as being grievance, and I don't, you know, I think that when you are, you know, I've had people, you know, I'll use a personal example. You know, I'm African-American and white. I have natural hair. And the number of times people are just desperate to touch my hair without asking me is higher than one would think for, you know, how often you think that you would like to manhandle someone else. And I'm like, please, you know, do not do this. And you'll have people who had no idea that they shouldn't do that. And so I think it's not necessarily a grievance. It's saying something like, this isn't workable for me and a lot of folks like me in how we're having this conversation across cultural lines. And I think that there are sometimes where I understand people being like, oh, that's too much. And I'm like, well, I'm sure it's been too much for the people who have been subjected to it. You know, it's not like things, you know, Chris Rock made the point in a comedy sketch a while back that, like, you know, it's not like African Americans improved. It's that we now are dealing with, like, the greatest group of white people ever experienced in American history. And so, you know, just thinking about all the stuff where, you know, people are like, oh, like, I never used to hear about, like, microaggressions or something. And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, when my dad was growing up, he was, you know, working on desegregating the Catholic school he attended as a child. So, you know, he didn't quite have time for that.
You had macro aggressions.
Yeah, you had like straight up macro, absolutely the most aggressive aggression.
Right.
And so I think that there's a sense where it's not, you know, I make this point a lot that one of the best things about America is the constant drive to improve, to reach a standard that one in America has ever been able to fit.
I just want to go on record.
That's part of it.
I just want to go on record as saying I've never been tempted to touch anyone's hair. And if anybody ever like reached over and touched my hair, I wouldn't think it was because of, you know, a microaggression. I would think you're just an idiot. You're a boor. Why don't do that? I mean, were you raised in a barn?
I think that that's part of it also. I think that there's a sense. I mean,
raised in a barn. Am I offending somebody when I say were you raised in a barn?
I don't believe
it. Unless
you take a very strict Christian perspective that the only person who was ever raised in the barn was Jesus.
Oh, geez. Oh, see, so 20 years from now, somebody's going to come back and they're going to take this out and there's going to be whatever Twitter is back then, you know, psychs. Okay, so I want to get to Trump's tweets. So going back to, and I know the most obnoxious thing in the world is to talk about a TV show that one person has seen, the other person hasn't seen. But Aziz Ansari, actually, when he's talking about wokeness, starts off with a case of cultural appropriation. And you'll remember it was when the high school girl wore a Chinese dress to her prom. And
right.
and some of the Asian students were offended by this. And he tells the story about how one of them goes up to her and says, you know, hey, I just want you to know how this makes me feel, that I feel that you may be disrespecting a culture that I value. And she says, well, you know, thank you for mentioning that to me, because I was not aware that this would have this effect. And then, of course, Aziz goes, which, of course, did not happen. Of course, they didn't have that conversation. You know, what somebody did was they went on Twitter and they you know, had this, you know, absolute conflagration of cultural appropriation. And it became a way for people to demonstrate their wokeness. And he goes on and he introduces the whole subject by the way in which white people and progressives just, you know, feel the need to demonstrate it, to perform it as flamboyantly as possible. And obviously, because you spend time around conservatives, you know how the backlash to that, how exhausting that can be.
Well, I think also it's worth remembering that one of the most important words you just used is Twitter. And I think that this kind of back and forth, because I feel like there's a sense in which this kind of back and forth is happening on Twitter, which is a platform that's the least effective for it.
Yeah.
The absolute least. And so, you know, I understand. For example, why did we know about this happening at all? You know, is it news? Is it newsy? Is it news-ish? I don't know. And so I think that there's a sense that a lot of times when this is happening on a social media platform, and I'd use also the example, you know, sometimes it's been extremely helpful because, you know, when African Americans armed with cell phone cameras can note things like, you know, having the cops called on you for being in the foyer of your own apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that's worth, that's, you know, that's significant because it's indicative of something that African Americans have been talking about for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that there's something about Twitter rage, which does turning into this kind of performative thing, but it's performative for only people who are on Twitter, and the vast majority of Americans are not on Twitter. But like, I just...
Yeah, how did we know about it? That's an interesting question, and I'm guessing it's because somebody hears the story and figured they could plug that into their own outrage machine. And I'm not sure which side of this divide plugged it in first. I can probably guess. So okay, let's get to Donald Trump's tweets, because this is, like I mentioned before, you know, this is industrial grade racism. I mean, I wrote this morning, you know, there's no point in debating whether or not this is racism. Of course it's racism. And yet, as you watch it play out, I just want to get your take on all of this, because, I mean, some things feel old, but they're still outrageous. Not a single, as you and I are speaking, not a single elected Republican in the nation has pushed back on President Trump for these tweets. For people who are listening historically, these are for the four minority progressive congresswomen, basically saying you should go back to your shithole countries where you came from, crime infested countries, before you criticize this country. And, you know, it certainly escalates everything that's been happening here. So your take on this, I'm just going to, you know, spoiler alert, I think this is going to be politically effective for Donald Trump. I would like to believe there's going to be a huge backlash. People go, oh my God, the president of the United States is a racist. But we knew that. And I think that he, in this particular case, I think he knows what he's doing.
I mean, I think that there's this understanding that of Trump, which I find kind of humorous, that you see on both kind of the left and some versions of the right, that Trump is like playing 3D chess and knows what he's doing. And this whole thing is like, I don't think so. I think that he pops off and then people backfill to like be like, oh, what he actually meant. Oh, this, like, you know, you saw, I think Noah Smith made the point on Twitter of just like, oh, you know, this is a brilliant strategy or something like that. But like, no, I think this is the same person who gets very upset every morning watching Fox and Friends and decides that we all need to hear about it because that's how he uses Twitter. And you know, it's actually, it's kind of refreshing because he uses Twitter in the way that people used Twitter back in like 2009, where you'd just be like, man, those tacos were fire. But I do think that it creates this sensibility where what you're seeing now is people attempting to, what gets me is not the Trump tweet. It's like the Trump defenses, where it turns into like what he actually meant was, yes, oh, they should come back. Like that you get into this weird parsing out that Trump never did. At no point did Trump put any more than like 15 seconds worth of thought into any of this.
Oh, you know, I saw your tweet this morning where you thought, you know, that maybe people should just admit they simply don't care what he says rather than developing these M.C. Escher-level defenses.
Right. I would much rather if you were just like, well, the economy is good, so I just don't care. And I'm like, you know what? That is a perspective. It is not one that I share, but, you know, that is something I'd be like, okay, that's fine. But I think that, you know, when you start attempting to construct defenses for which even Trump himself, he deleted the tweets and then like reworded them in a way that was somehow stupider. But like, you know, when you're rewording things in a way that, you know, in order to make this make sense, rather than just being like, well, that's just what he does, you know, or doing this whole like, oh, objecting to Trump tweets is how you got Trump, which is, it's, I find such a funny a funny construction for people who are reportedly Trump supporters, but also talk about him like he's like the wicked witch of the West. Like, oh no, if you do this, then he'll come and do something. But, you know, I think that with this, it's been clear for years that Trump is a racist. And, you know, and as I said, there are gradations of racism. You know, I've written about how, you know, Trump's racism is the kind of racism where he assumed that Ben Carson and members of the Congressional Black Caucus already knew each other because of course they would. You know, he has the racism of every, you know, if you call in to like, if you used to call into Mike and the Mad Dog and had a lot of thoughts on why Donovan McNabb was never going to be an elite quarterback because of reasons. You know, that's that kind of racism. It's a very familiar kind of racism. This isn't like, you know, this isn't Mencius Moldbug or the neo-reactionaries. Like, we haven't quite gotten to that point yet where we're starting getting into, like, deep dives into scientific racism. You know, this is just how okay. Trump has been for his entire life.
And it's worked for him. Okay, so let me push back a little bit, although I have really mixed feelings on this because I completely agree with you. And I have for years now, you know, argued against the three-dimensional chess Donald Trump is some deep strategic thinker, you know, who plans this out. I really do think of him more like Chauncey Gardner from Being There. You know, he just says stuff and people go, oh, wow. You know, but on the other hand, there's a certain reptilian cunning that you have to give him credit for. And he knows that by attacking these four, he does accomplish some things. I mean, number one, he knows he will not be hurt at all by his own base. He will not be hurt by the Republicans. You know, the GOP will stand behind him. He you know, understood that. He also understands, I think, that he's going to trigger the libs by getting the Democrats now to rally around and defend these four women who he would love to be the face of the Democratic Party. And I thought it was interesting because there was a sense over the weekend the Democrats had finally had it with AOC and the whole squad. There was that leaked poll which would suggest that she's toxic with, you know, non-college educated swing voters. And, you know, you had what he's done is he's got the Democrats all going, no, we're with these, we're with them. He's baited them into raising their profile even more.
So my argument, one, that poll, which, I would love to see more information on that, because that poll also said that, you know, the same group of 1,000 non-college educated white voters also don't like the Democratic Party or Nancy Pelosi. So, you know, there's something to be said for polling data where just like they just don't like any Democrats. Right. So I'm like, well, you know, that checks out. But I do think that there's something, one, I think that we've made in news media, the mistake of overcorrecting, where we went from like, there is no way Trump could possibly win, which wasn't true, to Trump winning is inevitable because everyone supports him, which isn't true. Also, he is hilariously unpopular and remains hilariously unpopular, and especially with this good of an economy, that's never really happened before. And I think that one thing that's worth noting is when we talk about Trump's base, you know, I said before that I really like defining terms.
Right.
Trump's base is not just people who voted for him in 2016. You know, if Trump's base, I would think of as being like diehards, because, you know, I would not think there are a lot of people who voted for Barack Obama in 2008, but didn't vote for him in 2012. That's not who Obama's base was. And so I think that there's a sense that, you know, in 2018, the people who peeled off from the GOP, were suburban white women for whom Trump was just, I think, you know, and I can't think of a better term than this, but they thought he was gross. Mm-hmm. And gross is bad. You know, being gross is not an effective political strategy. And so I get that for people, you know, extremely online Trump supporters, there's this idea of like, well, if he's made, if he's made liberals mad, that's good. But I also think that, you know, if Trump wants to, you know, I've talked to down ballot GOP organizers in Pennsylvania, and, you know, they're talking about how, like, it has not been this bad in terms of, like, Republican outrage since we were stuffing envelopes for Ronald Reagan back in 1980. And I think that, you know, there's a sense that, I think something interesting is that, you know, I see kind of conservative commentators who are basically like, well, you know, what can Democrats possibly come up with? You know, we've got this great economy, we've got whatever. And honestly, I think Democrats are just saying like, you have Trump, we don't have Trump. Ergo, that's it. You know, honestly, you know, I joke to someone that like, if Joe Biden wins the nomination and if his entire acceptance speech is, I'm not Trump, good night, everybody, like, that's pretty effective.
Okay, so I agree with that. Yeah.
And so I think that there's, you know, for one thing, I think the fact that, you know, these four freshman congresswomen are this well known is interesting in and of itself. And I think, you know, there are lots of freshman Democratic congressmen like Lauren Underwood, Abigail
Spanberger,
like, yeah, there are a host of others. And so, and I also think like how people who are as plugged into politics feel about them is not necessarily how people who are not plugged into politics feel about them, because mercifully most people do not know, you know, do not care as much about this as
But let's go back. I'm going to go back to the reptilian cunning of Donald Trump. And you know, in his experience, what he has learned, or what he thinks he has learned, is that these appeals to racial division work for him, going back to birtherism, going back to Judge Curiel, the Muslim ban, the fine people in Charlottesville. I know I'm leaving out many, many, many. And each time there was this, the Mexican rapist, you know, there was the pushback, oh my God, this is divisive and everything, but it has worked for him. And
I would say that for a lot of people, and, you know, when I talk to Trump supportive people, they kind of put, you know, there are the people who are outright racial identitarians. You know, I've talked to kind of the identity of, but like the far right groups who are kind of actually kind of mad at Trump now because of Syria or something.
Right.
They can never quite decide how they feel. But then, you know, I would say for a lot of people, Trump's racism is very, it reminds them of this kind of like the racism that of other people that you kind of just like put to the side.
Right.
You know, you think of Trump as kind of like, you're, you know, oh, that's just like kind of our weird uncle.
Right.
And so I think that for a lot of people, being a racist is not disqualifying, because if it were,
clearly,
there'd be a lot of disqualifications. And so I think that it's not necessarily that his racism has worked. You know, it clearly, the fact that, you know, there was a time in which Republicans in Texas, you know, Rick Perry, George W. Bush could count on winning, like, you know, I think Rick Perry won something like 40% of Latino voters in Texas. And, mm-hmm. you know, the, I remember the GOP autopsy of 2012, which I think of as kind of like, you know, like what an anodyne document. But, you know, the idea of reaching out outside of kind of non-college educated white people is now the for the Republican Party that they'll speak to it sometimes. But, you know, when you even you have Senator Tim Scott being like, guys, come on, this is ridiculous. You know, I think it's not that it works, but I just think that there are a lot of folks who are willing to kind of put that out into like him being like him having cheated on his wife a bunch of times, him having like paid off these people. You kind of put it in this box, and that box, in for some people's view, is outweighed by the economy box or the my life is good box,
the judge's box, the abortion box, whatever.
Right.
Okay, but then how do you explain? And we're running out of time here, but how do you explain the Lindsey Grahams of the world? And here's Lindsey Graham, who's and I actually tweeted out yesterday that there once was a time, actually 2016 at one point, when there would have been Republicans who would have pushed back against these tweets. It would have been Paul Ryan would have, you know, had a press conference, and Lindsey Graham might have said something. Nikki Haley would have issued a statement. You would have heard from somebody like Jeff Flake. I mean, it wouldn't have amounted to anything. But as of right now, there's nothing, absolutely nothing. But then there's Lindsey Graham, who has clearly become a Trump loyalist, but never more so than today. And this is what he said in response to these tweets.
We all know that AOC and this crowd are a bunch of communists. They hate Israel. They hate our own country. They're calling the guards along our border, the Border Patrol agents, concentration camp guards. They accuse people who support Israel of doing it for the Benjamins. They're anti-Semitic. They're anti-America. Don't get down. Aim higher. We don't need to know anything about them personally. Talk about their policy.
Okay, so Jane, what is going on inside the minds of an elected Republican like Lindsey Graham that he would go all in on something that you would think that even among Trump supporters, they would put it in a box, kind of roll their eyes, not want to be associated? He's all in on this.
Well, I think that for Lindsey Graham's perspective, Tim Miller, who on Twitter had a joke that, you know, the year is 2029 and elderly Lindsey Graham has become President AOC's top GOP cheerleader and Instagram cooking assistant in the hopes he can convince her to advance regime change in Iran. And I honestly think like that's, you know, and I think Ala Pundit on Twitter also said like there's a 70% chance that happens. And I think that for a lot of people in Congress, the idea is, one, it's an opportunity. You know, when I talked to Representative Justin Amash, we talked about how Congress is now this weird oppositional force where it's like, well, if a Republican does it, you have to defend it until you die.
Yeah.
But if a Democrat does it, you need to call them out until someone else dies. But I think that there is a sense for Lindsey Graham that, like, you know, if I call Trump out, that'll only be bad for me. But if I don't call him out, it'll be good for me, and people will kind of just forget about it eventually.
Yeah, but why not just, like, disappear? I mean, well, why not just say, hey, you know, I got this thing. I can't go on TV to talk about this today. I get why you wouldn't want to necessarily attack Trump because of all the crap you'd get. Look what happened to Paul Ryan last week. But you don't have – but the full-throated, yes, he's absolutely right. They're communists. They hate Israel. They're anti-Semites. It's like, whoa. You could have gone to 8. Well, you didn't have to go to like 12.
Well, I also think though that there's this urge. You know, it kind of reminds me, and I normally do not make these comparisons, but you know, the will is there, but the flesh is weak. you know, you think of towards if anyone's seen the death of Stalin, there are numerous moments in which people are just like, you know, Stalin said this. Okay, Stalin said this. All right, we'll just, you know, we'll unarrest, we'll rearrest, we'll put, you know. you know, your wife wasn't to Siberia, your wife's back from Siberia, like where you just kind of follow him around and where he is your only, he is the fulcrum. And, you know, I've said that, you know, within the right, not conservatism, but within the right, you know, there is a, you know, anti, there's a reflective anti-leftism.
Yeah, that's
where it's
the
just
key.
Whatever the left is doing, we oppose it. And so there's this understanding that whatever that is, you need to have a sense that Lindsey Graham believes that, like, the biggest crisis in America is not Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But, I mean, that's not... Obviously, during the 2016 election, he felt differently. But, like...
It's all Flight 93 all the time now.
Right.
It's
no,
like
and
they're,
that is something... Gabriel Malore, I think, on Twitter said something like, is it just the Flight 93 election forever?
Yeah.
Like, that's just what we're doing, apparently, for the rest of our lives. It's that,
it is. No, and I think you have a good insight there that, you know, on the right, the main animating principle, you know, despite the rhetoric about constitutionalism and freedom and all of this stuff, it's really anti-leftism. It is fundamentally that. You know, you mentioned Tim Miller. This is where my mind's working here. So Tim also had a tweet about what the New Republic did over the weekend. I saw you tweeted about this.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to get my head around. This was a piece about Mayor Pete, lengthy piece by a writer who referred to him as Mary Pete. And to say that it was bizarre doesn't even begin to capture it. What was possibly going on inside the minds of the editors of the New Republic? Do you have any insight? Help me with this one.
I think that there's this. Sometimes people think that all ideas are inherently good ideas, or that controversial means good.
Yeah.
And so if you just say, like, the wildest take you have, you're like, ooh, that's edgy. And I'm like, no one quite knows what edgy is. You know, like, Robert Mapplethorpe was edgy. I don't know what this was. And so I think, though, that there's this, it's also this weird understanding of, you know, the writer who himself is gay is basically making the argument that you have to, that, you know, part of the piece, which first goes through a very long anecdote that makes no sense. Then it gets to this argument that because Mayor Pete came out of the closet in his early 30s and then married Chasen, his husband, that at some point Mayor Pete will have to go through gay puberty. I'm using hand quotes, which means nothing for a podcast. And he'll cheat on his husband and have sex with everybody all over the White House because that's what gay men do, which is this weird thing where I'm like, that's the most homophobic thing I've heard in a long time. And it's coming from someone who is gay, whose understanding of being gay is based on this, like, very 1972 Christopher Street Parade idea that, like, if you're not doing these things in a specific way, you know, you're either not really gay or you haven't really done gay right. And I think that there's this, it was a very, you know, I think that one of the interesting things that people do is that, you know, you see intra-community conflict as like, oh, that, like, as a harbinger that there's something wrong. When I don't think there is, I think the fact that you can have these kind, you know, you can have this kind of divergent opinion within the LGBT community is fine. But I also think that this article, you know, someone was like, oh, were you offended by it? I'm like, no, I have been offended by things. I just thought this was stupid.
It was stupid. It was. And that's why I keep looking, thinking of the I think your explanation is the only one that the editor is looking at this and going, well, this is edgy. This, well, people will talk about this. Well, it can't be homophobic because the author is gay. And so now we're opening up a whole new, and, you know, as Tim Miller, I don't have his tweet right in front of me, but it was basically like, what the F were they thinking to publish this thing? I usually can figure out, like, what someone was thinking. This one, I just have no idea. Well, the New Republic has fallen on some dark days. So what is your sense, Jane? Do you think Trump gets reelected next year?
I have no idea. Think that there's also, I am out of the prognostication business. I will not do it. I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, let alone.
We all got crushed on this last time, man.
So I think that, though, I think it's going to be an interesting challenge because we have never seen a president this unpopular with the economy being this good. And also, a lot can change. You know, I would, I always recommend Steve Kornacki's book, The Red and the Blue.
Yeah.
Because something it gets across is if you looked at the numbers in October 1991 for George H.W. Bush, where he'd like 90% approval, and granted that's coming off the Gulf War, and then he lost like less than a year later, or a little over a year later, I apologize. Yeah. You know, anything can happen.
With less than 40% of the vote.
Yeah, and you can have... You could have somebody jump into this race who does a Ross Perot type thing and allegedly peels off votes, which someone's child will be mad about for 30 years. You know, you can have a lot take place, and you know, it's July. You know, I feel like I'm just wandering around newsrooms saying it's July 2019. Like, we don't know anything. We're at this point. You know, only one candidate has dropped out of the Democratic primary. Like, I think that there's a lot left. There's a lot we don't know. Yeah. And you know, whenever people are like, but this indicator says this, I'm like, a lot of indicators could say a lot of things. I think it's the same thing. You know, I got into journalism by writing about sports, specifically college football. And occasionally people ask me things about like, you know, do you bet on college football? And I say no, because I've seen things and I'm not insane. And so, yes, I am certain that you could prognosticate like, yes, like, Michigan over Wisconsin by 7.5 or something like that. And people would be like, oh, that sounds great. And I'm thinking, like, I've watched a lot of college football, and 7.5 at Wisconsin and Camp Randall sounds like a really bad idea. Now, I could also be wrong. Maybe Michigan wins by 30. I don't know. But I think that, you know, if there's anything I've learned from sports, it's that we don't know anything, and that anything could happen.
I should have that tattooed on my hand, so the next time I'm you know, on one of those panels, just hold it up, and you know, it's July. We don't know anything. So.
No, we absolutely do not know anything, and I think that there is, you know, we see this a lot, and we've seen this throughout history, of people want, you know, I talked about how conspiracy theories tend to arise when people want something to cling to, and you can build an entire worldview. You can do your world building, so to speak, through conspiracy theories, because the alternative is to acknowledge that the world doesn't make sense and will never make sense, and you will never understand it, which for apparently most people they cannot do. You know, but I think that politics is much the same. You know, this idea of like, this can't happen, this won't happen, this should, you know, can't and won't and shouldn't aren't the same thing. And so I would say, you know, if anyone asks me anything about like 2020, my answers are, it's July and I don't know.
Jane Costin, thank you so much for joining me. I appreciate it very much.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me.
I only got through half of my notes. You and I could have hours to talk about this, including some questions like, you need to explain to me what you think I don't understand about conservatism. So we'll have you back on, because we have repeat. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.